As many of you already know, Hebrews chapter 11 is a chapter that records some of the most well-known spiritual exploits performed by the people of God during the era, the epoch of the Old Testament scriptures. And dear friends, the reason why Hebrews 11 appears in this particular letter is for the specific purpose of addressing a most serious spiritual concern. This chapter is full of joyous things and records of great victory among the people of God, and yet it was written to address an exceedingly important spiritual problem. And that is to say, some of the professing Hebrew Christians to whom this letter had been written were teetering on the very brink of apostasy. That is to say, because of mounting persecution and opposition and hostilities, some among these professing Christians were actually giving serious consideration to an abandonment of the gospel, of turning their backs on Jesus Christ. And so the pastor who pens this letter prayerfully thinks to himself, how can I encourage my dear people? How can I motivate my dear people? How can I stimulate and arouse them to fresh perseverance in their Christian walk? Because the fact of the matter is, the consequences of falling away from Jesus Christ are eternally disastrous. He has said that to us on several occasions throughout this letter already. And as he's scratching his head, thinking about how it is he might encourage these believers, suddenly, as it were, the Spirit of God fills his mind with the answer to this question by posing to him a second question. How did all of our great forebears from the past endure? How did men like Abraham endure, and men like Noah? How did Noah endure, and how did Jacob and Joseph endure all of the hostilities and the antagonisms? I mean, they faced some enormous difficulties, enormous challenges. How was it that they endured in the face of all of those things, those great saints of the Old Testament? And the writer of this letter, beloved, would have thought to himself, I know the answer to this question. They endured by faith. They persevered by the means of faith. It stands to reason then that if such a thing was true for them, it will also prove to be true for us at this very critical moment of our lives. And so, as it were, he says now to these Hebrew Christians, it is faith, dear brothers, that is absolutely indispensable in persevering in the Christian life. You will never be able to endure to the end as a Christian apart from faith. And so what is it, again, beloved, that we read over and over and over throughout the better part of this chapter? We've come to see it, that little prepositional phrase, by faith. By faith, it is what we call a dative of manner. It means acting on the basis of faith. Verse 4, Abel offered God a better sacrifice. Verse 5, acting on the basis of faith, Enoch was taken from this life. Verse 7, acting on the basis of faith, Noah built the ark. Verse 8, acting on the basis of faith, Abraham obeyed and went. Verse 11, acting on the basis of faith, Abraham was enabled to become a father. Verse 17, acting on the basis of faith, Abraham offered Isaac as a sacrifice. Verse 20, acting on the basis of faith, Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau. Verse 21, acting on the basis of faith, Jacob blessed each of Joseph's sons. Verse 22, acting on the basis of faith, Joseph spoke about the exodus of the Israelites. Over and over again, the Hebrew writer drills this into our minds so that an indelible impression is left upon them. It was by the means of faith that these exploits were performed. Acting on the basis of faith is what has always enabled the saints of God to successfully persevere. But friends, all of this, of course, begs the question that we've answered in past weeks and months, but need to remind ourselves of again this morning, and that is, what is it that we have come to understand about the nature of this faith? What is this faith? People talk about faith all of the time. What is true biblical faith? And we've attempted to set forth before you the fact that faith, authentic faith, is not a kind of quasi-mystical feeling that overcomes a person who just so happens to be susceptible to certain kinds of spiritual influences. No, authentic faith, biblical faith, is much more objective and concrete than that. As we have come to see again and again throughout this chapter, beloved, a Hebrews 11 kind of faith is a faith that is a reasoned, rational, righteous response to revelation. It is a righteous reaction to the prior revelation of God. So it is not a response to nothing or a response to what might be our own imaginations, but a response to what God Himself has set forth before us. It is, as it were, a hearing of the promise of God, an understanding of the promise of God, an embracing of the promise of God, and a staking of the life upon the promise of God. Christian faith is not an empty-headed hoping for the best, crossing my fingers and wishing well. It is a wholehearted reliance upon God's immovable and invincible word that has come to us. In other words, God speaks, and upon that word, we then shape our lives and stake our eternities. Even when doing so, seems altogether unconventional. Like the building of a giant ark, or the offering up of a son in sacrifice, or the crossing of an ocean floor with walls of water at your right and left. Now, beloved, when we drew things to a close last time, we found ourselves at a very happy period in Israel's history. Through an amazing display of God's wonderful providence, the tiny nation of Israel, made up of one man and his extended family, finds itself living in the region of Goshen, the best and most fruitful portion of the nation of Egypt. And if you can actually imagine it, one of this man's sons, Joseph, actually becomes the second most powerful man in the land at that time. He becomes prime minister. And so for the next several years, this little Jewish family thrives, and it grows, and it prospers, and it expands. Well, by and by, the ancient patriarch Jacob dies. And then finally, at the ripe old age of 110, Joseph himself dies. But the memory of his great work among the Egyptian people lingers favorably. And so his remaining family members continue to prosper. They continue to grow. They continue to expand right there in Egypt. Life goes on. Generation gives way to generation, and more than 300 years go by. But over this time, a subtle but very real evolution occurs. That is, one Egyptian king replaces another Egyptian king. One dynasty replaces another dynasty. One pharaoh is succeeded by yet another pharaoh, and finally a man ascends the throne for whom the name of Joseph bears no meaning. A man ascends the throne for whom the name of Joseph carries with it no charms, no influence, no effect. In fact, if you open your Bibles up to Exodus chapter 1 and 2, you very quickly discover that for all intents and purposes, the new Pharaoh is saying, "Who gives a rip about Joseph?" The fact of the matter is, as he looks over the current state of things, he thinks to himself, "These people who came to us via Joseph now pose a monumental threat to our national security." You see, over these 300 plus years, beloved, that once small displaced family has become a multitude numbering over 2 million people. And the Egyptian king knows very well that if these Hebrews ever determine to side with the enemies of Egypt, Egypt's future is finished. So how does he seek to deal with the problem? You know the story. He seeks to crush the spirit of the Hebrew people under his foot by way of wicked and violent oppression. And so these Hebrew shepherds, who for the better part of 300 years have enjoyed working in the fruitfulness of Goshen, are now taken out of that context, forcefully drafted into service for mud pits and for brick fields, now exercising their existence, eking out their existence under the watchful eye and cruel whip of the violent taskmasters. And if you know anything about your Old Testaments, you know that this becomes an exceedingly dark and bleak time for the Hebrew people perhaps the most dark and bleak time they were ever to know. The fact of the matter is, beloved, occasions for joy and occasions for celebration and occasions for any kind of happiness were few and far between. One of the sources of delight, one of the sources of happiness, however, was the occasional announcement of a wedding. And one day, just such an announcement was forthcoming. A man by the name of Amram and a woman by the name of Jochebed meet. They fall in love and they get married. And it's not too terribly long before there's even more wonderful news. Jochebed becomes pregnant. And so she has a daughter, and she names her daughter Miriam. And sometime later, she becomes pregnant again and gives birth to a son, and they name him Aaron. And yet a third time, it seems that the light of God's blessing has penetrated the darkness of these bleak days. Jochebed is yet pregnant a third time. Only this time, the experience of joy is suddenly shattered by a sensation of terror. Because in a spasm of cruelty, Pharaoh seeks to stem the Hebrew population explosion by way of murder. He calls together the Hebrew midwives and he tells them, if a woman gives birth to a baby girl, let the baby live. If she gives birth to a baby boy, then put that baby to death. Can you imagine living in such a time? Can you imagine, dear friends, the agony of bearing a child for 9 months? And the day comes when the labor sets in, and the midwife arrives, and the pushing begins, and the breathing becomes heavy, and the head crowns, and the baby emerges from the birth canal, and suddenly you hear words that are the most dreadful words that you could have ever heard. It's a boy. Well, the book of Exodus tells us that this plan of Pharaoh failed because the midwives refused to kill the babies. So at that particular point, Pharaoh devises a new plan. It's more crude, to be sure, but it is in fact more effective. A decree is issued, ultimately executed by the Egyptian military, and that decree is this: all newborn babies are to be thrown into the Nile River. And so perhaps in a systematic way, Egyptian soldiers visit the homes of the Hebrew people, one by one, looking for baby boys. How Pharaoh must have laughed with sadistic delight at his plan. Patted himself on the back for his great ingenuity. The slaughtering of male babies, it was a stroke of genius. Not only would it stem the increasing population of these Hebrews, it would crush their spirit like no other form of oppression they had ever experienced. And yet, beloved, I want to tell you something that we discover in the Bible over and over and over again. We need to appreciate the fact that wicked men at their worst can never even for a moment interrupt, frustrate, or compromise the plan of God in the slightest way. For all of his wickedness, Pharaoh could not undo the promise that God had made to Abraham and the other patriarchs. A promise which said this: you will go to Egypt, there the nation will blossom. 400 years later, you will be delivered out of that nation and brought into a land flowing with milk and honey. Now that promise came from God, and thus it would never be frustrated in any way. And so it is irony upon ironies that it is during these very dark days under the oppression of Pharaoh that Jochebed gives birth to a baby boy who would be the very deliverer of God's people. A boy, beloved, if you think about this, this is astounding. A boy who would not only escape the murderous rage of Pharaoh, but a boy who would actually be saved by Pharaoh's daughter, raised in Pharaoh's house, educated in Pharaoh's schools, and trained in Pharaoh's court. God will use the wrath of men to praise him. The psalmist, I've been thinking about Psalm 2 all week. The psalmist asks, why do the nations conspire and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth take their stand, and the rulers gather together against the Lord and against His anointed one. Let us break their chains, they say, and throw off their fetters. The one enthroned in heaven laughs. The Lord scoffs at them, then He rebukes them in His anger and terrifies them in His wrath. You see, beloved, it is right in the midst of Pharaoh's wickedness that God lays the foundation that will ultimately serve to deliver His people and judge the Egyptians. And two of the instruments that He uses in the process are the parents of Moses. And I want to tell you this morning, I'm really glad that they're here. I'm really glad that they're here in Hebrews chapter 11, because the fact is, we don't tend to think of them as great heroes of the Old Testament epoch. And yet they clearly will display for us this morning a faith that vanquishes fear, a faith that we will see emerging in the life of their boy Moses next Lord's Day, a courageous and bold faith that overcomes the fear of people, the fear of what people might think of us. In our particular context, beloved, the fear of what people might think of us because we are Christians and live like Christians and speak like Christians. This is something you see that these Hebrew Christians to whom this letter was originally written desperately needed to see, as their own faith was beginning to vacillate just a little bit in the face of this coming persecution. And dear friends, this is something that even to this day has bearing upon our own lives. It's something that we need to hear with a measure of urgency. Because the fact of the matter is, if we're honest with one another this morning, the fear of other people is something that we all face, isn't it? I wish I could stand here this morning and tell you that I've come to a place in my life where I am altogether beyond the fear of men. That I'm never afraid to speak for Christ, never afraid to speak for the Bible, that when I'm preparing a message and thinking about what the Bible is saying, that it never dawns on me how people will think or how they'll respond or how they will view me, that I'm never fearful of what the reactions of other people might be. Friends, the fact of the matter is, such a thing would be a lie. Such a thing wouldn't be the truth. The fact of the matter is, I think for all of us here, the fear of other people is a lifelong struggle. There are seasons, I think, when we are more bold and more courageous than on other occasions. Other occasions when we find ourselves less bold and less courageous. But the reason why this needs to be pressed into our consciences this morning, why it merits our attention, is because, you see, it is a weapon that the enemy can use to neutralize our effectiveness with the gospel. My friend Steve Fernandes loves to quote this verse from the book of Proverbs, "Fear of man will prove to be a snare." You're afraid of people, and it will cripple your spiritual influence with them. What kind of faith vanquishes fear? What kind of faith overcomes the instinctive fear we have of other people, their response to us, their view of us? And the answer to this question, beloved, is simply this. It is a faith that bows to the supremacy of heavenly authority. What kind of faith vanquishes fear? In this particular instance, it proves to be a faith that bows to the supremacy of heavenly authority. In other words, this is a faith which recognizes that every earthly person and every earthly potentate, every earthly power, all of these things are ultimately subject to the final and supreme authority of God Himself. And I want to tell you something, beloved, on a practical level, when we know this to be true, when we feel its import in our lives right down to our bones and it grips us, it can vanquish the dread of men that will otherwise paralyze us. One of the Puritans, William Gurnall, said it this way, "We fear men so much because we fear God so little. One fear cures another." Fear of God cures fear of men. Now you see, dear friends, Amram and Jochebed have a choice to make. The royal decree itself is unmistakable. Moses is to be thrown into the Nile River. Moses is to be fed to the crocodiles. This is the royal decree. Now, it is true, brothers and sisters, that the scriptures themselves teach us as the people of God that we are to be characterized as a people who are submissive to authority. One of the evidences of being filled with the Spirit, Ephesians 5, is being submissive to authority. And what's even more clear in the New Testament than this, Romans chapter 13, is that people who occupy positions of authority in our lives have been placed in those positions by God Himself. In speaking even of the government and governing authorities, Paul tells us in Romans chapter 13 that they are actually servants, ministers of God. However, when allegiance to earthly authority and heavenly authority come up against each other in an irreconcilable way, our duty must always be to bow to the supremacy of heavenly authority. For example, you remember the story, Daniel chapter 3? King Nebuchadnezzar sets up a statue. It's a monument to himself, 90 feet tall. And a decree is issued in the kingdom that at the appropriate time, everybody is to fall to the ground and worship that statue. And three Hebrew men who are exemplary citizens in every other aspect of their lives, they refuse. And so they are summarily brought before the king, who threatens them with death in a fiery furnace. You remember that scene. And how do Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego respond? They say this: "We want you to know, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up." Now, I would appeal to you, my dear friends, you must understand this is not rogue individualism on the part of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. We're not talking about men who just kind of like to pride themselves in their own autonomy and sense of self-direction. What they have is the Word of God on this issue. And in the opening of the law of God, Exodus 20, God says, "You shall not make for yourself an idol in the form of anything in heaven above or on earth beneath or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God." For them, it was an easy issue. It was a crisis of authority. God has spoken clearly on this issue. The king is asking us to do the contrary. How do we respond? And the answer is simple. We always respond to heavenly authority over against earthly authority. Dear friends, are we obligated to earthly authority here? You can't get away from the fact that we are, if you're going to read the Bible honestly, whether we're talking about employers to employees, parents to children, husbands to wives, pastors to people, government to citizenry. We are bound to earthly authority, submissive to them, until that earthly authority commands us to do something God forbids or forbids us to do something God commands. In Daniel chapter 6, when a decree is issued from the king that all citizens must refrain from praying, does Daniel stop praying? No. And because of that, he gets thrown into the lion's den. Now, God preserves him there. We don't have a promise from the Bible that God will always preserve us in such situations. But Daniel at that point says no to earthly authority, that he might say yes to heavenly authority. And when Peter and John are commanded, Acts chapter 4, Acts chapter 5, by the powers that be, to stop preaching the gospel, what is it that they say? "We must obey God rather than men." Now, you can flog us, you can kill us, but we can't stop speaking about what we have seen and what we have heard. There is at this particular point a higher, greater, more ultimate authority. And you see, beloved, now this is the very thing that is facing Amram and Jochebed. The word of Pharaoh has come down. This baby boy must die. Their response: acting on the basis of faith, Moses' parents hid him for 3 months after he was born. There's no other way around it. It was a flagrant, blatant, overt disregard of royal authority. You say, well, Art, come on, why are you making such a big deal about this? Any parent would have done the very same thing as Amram and Jochebed. But, beloved, what you need to understand here, what the writer of Hebrews is telling us, is that what motivated Amram and Jochebed to hide Moses for 3 months was something more than merely natural affection of a parent for a child. Notice here that their action in the text is not ascribed to parental love, natural parental affection. It is stated to be a direct expression of their faith. Did you see this? Acting on the basis of faith. Moses' parents hid him for 3 months. And once again, what is it that we've come to understand about authentic faith? That faith is not faith in an imaginary something, something that we hope to be true. Faith is always a response to revelation, which tells us this, that while we don't have as much information about this story as we would like, it appears that the parents of Moses knew something from God about the destiny of this boy. At the very least, what would have these parents known? What could have these parents known for sure? Well, they were acquainted with God's promises to the patriarchs. They knew God's covenant promise. They knew that the people of Israel would be taken to Egypt, where they would grow as a nation, and 400 years later they would be delivered out of Egypt into Canaan. They know that it's been 400 years. They know that just about the time Moses comes of age, he may be fit to do this work. They can do the math. This baby had been born at just the right time. But notice also what the text says in a rather cryptic note, to be sure. By faith, Moses' parents hid him for 3 months after he was born because they saw he was no ordinary child. Now, if you have a New American Standard Bible, it says they could see that he was a beautiful child. And that obscures things even worse than simply saying he was no ordinary child. Again, beloved, what is being stressed here, I appeal to you, is not the natural, protective, instinctual affection of a mother for a baby. The issue here is not that they could see that Moses was this unusually beautiful baby. Because that wouldn't be unique to Amram and Jochebed, would it? That's the universal experience of all parents. The fact of the matter is, I said in the first service this morning, the only babies that I ever thought were attractive were my own. I don't think babies are particularly attractive. The issue is not that they thought that this was a baby who could be on the cover of some kind of a magazine. Rather, there is this perception. Remember, they're acting on the basis of faith. There is this perception seen here only by the eyes of faith, a perception that perceives deeper than physical attractiveness and goes beyond natural affection. In fact, the word here translated ordinary, or again beautiful if you have a New American Standard, is a word that originally meant polite or town bred, or what we would call today being well bred. And by and by it came to be used as a term to speak of something that had been approved, a person, a thing that had been accepted, or something that had been approved, or something that had come to be regarded as pleasing. Now, what is very fascinating about this, beloved, and we have to take the little bits that we have in the Bible and kind of pull it all together. In Acts chapter 7, Stephen, when he's preaching before the Sanhedrin, speaks about Moses and speaks about this very scene in his life. And Stephen, under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, says that Moses was, and he uses the very same word, acceptable, approved in the sight of God. some way not explicitly revealed to us in the book of Exodus, it was apparent to Amram and Jochebed that Moses had been identified and set apart by God for some great purpose in God's redemptive program. Somehow, in some way, we do not know how, beloved, this child Moses possessed to the eye a visible, unique sign of God's elective favor. Now, the first century Jewish historian Josephus tells us that Amram had been assured by God in a dream that Moses would be the deliverer of the people of Israel. At the time of the writing of the book of Hebrews, it was common belief among the Jewish people that Amram, the father of Moses, had received a revelation from God, a vision at night. Now, we can't know that for sure, of course, because the text doesn't tell us. It may have, in fact, been true. However, at the very least, what we can say is this. Since faith is a response to revelation, somehow the parents of Moses knew from God himself that this boy had been appointed by God to play a role in God's purposes for God's people. They are acting on the basis of faith. This, beloved, you see, this, the conviction of this fact, this absolute trust in the integrity of God's promise, however it had come down to them, was the thing that gave strength to the parents of Moses that would vanquish the fears of what might befall them in the event that they were discovered defying the authority of the king. This was the thing that emboldened them. This was the thing that strengthened them. This was, as it were, why they could have said along with Peter and John, "We must obey God rather than men." Their fears were vanquished by their confidence in the revelation of God. And what's been running through my mind, ringing through my mind this past week, have been those two verses out of "A Mighty Fortress Is Our God" that gets at this very thing. "And though this world with devils filled should threaten to undo us, we will not fear, for God has willed his truth to triumph through us. The prince of darkness grim, we tremble not for him. His rage we can endure, for lo, his doom is sure. One little word shall fell him. That word above all earthly powers, no thanks to them abideth. The spirit and the gifts are ours through him who with us sideth. Let goods and kindred go, this mortal life also. The body they may kill, God's truth abideth still. His kingdom is forever." This, beloved, was the song, you see, of Amram and Jochebed. "We will not fear, for God hath willed his truth to triumph through us. God has given to us his promise. We'll step out in faith upon the reliability of that promise." That's the kind of faith, you see, that vanquishes fear. A faith that bows to the supremacy of heavenly authority over against all earthly authority. They trusted God's word over against everything else. And how do we know that for sure? Because they acted upon this word. Isn't that what the text tells us? Acting on the basis of faith, Moses' parents hid him for 3 months after he was born. They hid him for 3 months. Are you awake this morning? You ever tried to hide a baby? You ever tried to hide a baby for 3 months? Especially for people who are on the lookout for babies? How do you hide the piercing cry of a baby? Beloved, I submit to you this morning, every time Moses cried out for milk, it would have sent a shockwave up and down the spine of Jochebed. "Shh! Don't cry. Please, Moses, don't cry." And how do you hide the scent of a baby? And what about uninvited guests? What about that unexpected knock on the door? Have we been found out? Does someone know? What if they hear the baby cry? Will someone discover the baby? What will they do if they find out? One wonders how frequently Amram was in a cold sweat because one of his co-workers talked about walking home with him after work one day from the mud pits. Why don't I go to your house and we sit down and have a cup of coffee today after work, Amram? And what about the perennial busybody who lives next door? You know, the woman always prying into everybody's business, wondering why it is that Jochebed hadn't been out in such a long time? And what about their own children? What about Miriam and Aaron? I could imagine Amram and Jochebed sitting down with their children every single morning.